Hi. My name is Ward. I'm a long-term friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very grateful to be here. Thank you for the invitation. A little bit about myself, so you get the framework. I am an ordained Episcopal minister. I'm one of those that used to happen a long time ago. I went from college to seminary to ordained. So I have had 32 years in active congregational ministry. And then, and 13 of those were in Buffalo. So I'm a hardship sort of guy, you know. And then I was elected the dean and president of our seminary in New York City. So I did 10 more years in the city. Yeah, that's enough about that. My story with the fellowship, you know, we do how it was, what happened, and how it is now. I'm going to do what happened, then how it was, and how it is now, okay? So what happened was I got in a congregation as the chief pastor, small congregation, where it became clear to me after just a few months that alcohol was causing a lot of members of the congregation some real problems. A couple of young people talked with me about problems in their homes. Folks were clearly in trouble, and it seemed like alcohol was frequently a piece of that. And I had absolutely no idea what to do. I had enough sense to know that telling them to stop drinking wouldn't help. That I give myself credit for, because we'd done prohibition in this country, and we figured that one out, right? But I needed to know about this illness, and so I decided to go to, as I said earlier today, I decided to go to the experts, and I started attending open AA meetings. Now, this is 1975, and some of you who've been around a long time remember those days. They were mostly smoking meetings, and I mean mostly smoking. And if you sat in the back, you couldn't see the speaker. And I would come home, and I would clothes filled with smoke. And I would say, "Jenny, I'm home." And she would say, "Yes, I smell you. Take off your clothes and leave them outside." Which was a bit of a mixed message. But so I began learning, okay? And it was about 5 years after that, 1980, a member of our congregation who had 7 years sobriety in the program walked into my office. His name was Willie. And he said, "Ward, you're the spiritual expert, right?" I don't think I answered that. He said, "I'm out of touch with God, and the last time I was out of touch with my higher power, I drank, and if I drink again, I may die, and I need you to put me back in touch with God." And that was the second intelligent thing I did, was that I recognized I couldn't do that. But we talked, we had a couple of conversations, but we decided that what we needed to have was a small group of members of AA, all of whom had at least 5 years sobriety, and this was not to be an AA group, who wanted to deal with spiritual issues in their life. Because one of the challenges of this spiritual program is when you get into some spiritual questions and problems and struggles, AA is not the place to take those. AA has one purpose, and it's not dealing with theology or doubt or spiritual challenges. But I also knew that I didn't have the wisdom or the experience to have answers. So we started this small group. We met every Tuesday afternoon for the next 5 years until I moved away. And guess what happened to the spiritual expert? His life was transformed and changed. That small group is probably the most important spiritual aspect of my life. And there's really one primary, there are a lot of reasons, but there's one primary reason, and that is they didn't care what I'd done, whether I was absolutely wonderful or absolutely terrible. They didn't care if I'd been a great success or if I'd been a terrible failure. They cared for me to be honest. That was the only criteria in that group. If we're going to deal with spiritual issues and if we're going to deal with them really and truly, then we have to be honest as we can be, recognizing that my honesty today in 3 weeks might shift just a little bit as I live into that. I remember one event. One of the members of the group was killed in an industrial accident, and it really upset me. And I was, I guess, kind of emoting and really sharing my upset. And after probably too long, Willie turned to me and said, "Ward, shut up. He died sober. It's a victory, and we don't need to be moaning and groaning. This was a victory." That changed my whole view about death, about what makes a successful life. I mean, this was the kind of thing that was going on in that group. And it was incredibly important for me. Now, one of the real challenges for clergy, and this is true for all clergy, congregations do not want us to be honest. They want us to be good. And those two things are a long ways apart from each other. And what happens with clergy is because they can't be good, they can fake it. And they do. We do. And we can put on a front, and we can not answer a lot of questions, and we can not do a lot of this and that, and people think we're wonderful. But nobody wants me to get up and say, "I'm really hurting," or "I'm really in pain." Because I'm supposed to have faith and I'm supposed to be able to manage all those things. This group expected me to be honest. Now, after I moved from Louisville, and you'll think I'm crazy, we moved to Buffalo, New York. Loved it. But I love snow, because you have to if you live in Buffalo. And I needed that group, so I tried to recreate it. Well, over the next 4 or 5 years, I created 11 step groups, but I never got my group back again. You know, you get those gifts at one point, and they're transformative, and then you have to let go and move on. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But one of the things I learned, I then began developing clergy support groups. Phony bunch of clergy trying to get together and trying to be honest. I learned that I needed a member from this fellowship in that group if it was going to be worth anything. Because you guys have a great BS detector. And as long as I had a member of this fellowship as a part of my support group, we dealt honestly with the issues that were before us. And it was truly supportive. And when I didn't have, it was not a support group at all. I presently have a group that I meet with, and we live in Tennessee, way out in the boonies, and I drive 60 miles every Wednesday morning to meet with a group, two of whom, they're retired clergy, two of whom are members of this fellowship, and it's good. It's good. Y'all make a difference. That's how I got involved. And as I said, I continued to be involved. I ended up being a trustee. You know, this God business is really spooky. It is. I ended up being the president of General Seminary in New York, and I'd been there a couple of years, and I needed a new chief financial officer, and I was interviewing folks for the position, and one of the people I interviewed had some kind of characteristics that made me a little anxious. And I asked him about his drinking. And he asked me, "Why did I ask him about his drinking?" And I told him about the little things that made me a little anxious. And he said, "Well, that's interesting. I've got 22 years sobriety, and in AA. And then I shared my story, and he shared his story, and we had a wonderful time, and he didn't take the job. But about 2 months later, he called me up and said, would you be interested in being a trustee for the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous? I tell you, this God stuff is really coincidences. Let it be open. Let it happen. It's a spooky way to live a life. That's all I can say. So that's how I ended up being a trustee. I was elected in 04 and then elected chair in 09. And am now rotated and for 2 years have been a trustee emeritus. The rotation on the board means the board loses its memory. And so it really is a problem because they keep doing the same problems over and over again. Y'all probably have that at the local level too, a little bit, I'm sure. But so they asked the former chairs to continue as emeriti trustees. And so I'm still going to the meetings 4 times a year and still very much, and that's keeping me very much a part of this fellowship. So that's what happened and how I got involved. The question that's been interesting to me for the last few years is, and people have asked it of me so many times that I'm finally beginning to look at it, which is, why is this fellowship so important to me? And that goes back to how it was before. And it goes back to my teen years. And I don't really understand fully why my teen years were as tough as they were. But they were really tough. And in a very strange way, this may seem a little weird. I was the practically perfect teenager. I did everything right. I played basketball. I was all county. I had a paper route. I saved enough money on my paper route to pay my first year of college. Just the first. I had the best record collection in my class, so they would invite me to all the parties because I had all the records. And I felt totally isolated and totally alone. The image I had of how it felt like to be me was to be on a high pedestal, and everybody around me was looking up and applauding, and the pedestal was just the barely size for me to get my feet on it, and I couldn't step off, and I felt absolutely worthless. I felt that no one knew me or cared about me. I carried a level of guilt and shame that I don't even understand to this day. I thought a lot about suicide. I never attempted suicide. But I think if it hadn't been for the church, I would have. But somehow in the church, I discovered that there was a God who could love me even while I could not love myself. Those words may sound familiar. I have no friends from my high school days. I met my wife in those days at church camp. She used to call me the prude. And I still wonder to this day why and how she loved me. But I think I was a different person in the church. Somehow I came to understand that while I couldn't love myself and I couldn't feel like I was lovable, there was a loving presence there that truly cared for me. And it was out of that I then went on ultimately to be ordained as an Episcopal minister. My wife and I met when I was in high school or maybe even middle school. We haven't quite figured it out yet. Again, this God thing, you got to watch it. I graduated from seminary and was assigned to her home parish. We had kind of drifted apart, not totally, but pretty much. We were married the next May. Somehow she had seen a different me. I have good friends from seminary, but those years when I was on that pedestal were really painful years. And then as an ordained minister, I suddenly had to be good, and everybody wanted to put me back on that pedestal, and everybody wanted to stand around and applaud me, and I knew that would be murder. That would be death. What I needed was a place where I could be honest. And when Willie walked into my office and that group was developed, I suddenly had that place. And while it was not an AA group, they were all members, and it was home. The healing place is that kind of place where pain can be shared. I never could even talk about this until I was in my late 40s. I mean, it was painful. Now it's part of my life and it's part of my story because you've listened and because you brought me healing. But it takes that kind of sharing of a mutual hurt, if you like. I'm going to get away from my story for just a minute and share another story from Ernie Kurtz. This is about a little boy and a dog and a farmer. And the farmer just put the sign up on the fence, said, "Dogs for sale." And a little boy walked by and he said, "How much?" And he said, the farmer said, "Oh, they're expensive." And he said, "Can I see some?" And the farmer kind of looked at him and he said, he reached in his pocket and he pulled out his change. And he said, "I've got 42 cents. Could I see the puppies for 42 cents?" And the farmer said, "Sure." And he calls and he says, "Come on, Dixie." And the mother dog came out of the doghouse, and it was an elevated doghouse, down a ramp. And about five little balls of fur came following right after. And the boy was, you know, looking just right up against the fence. And then another little pup, little ball of fur, came down, almost rolled off, couldn't walk, was limping, and finally got to the fence. And the little boy said, "I want that one." And the farmer said, "That dog was born crippled, and he will never be able to run and play and be fun with you." And the little boy reached down and pulled up his pants leg, and you could see braces on his leg to his shoes. And he said, "I don't run and play so good myself either. He will need someone who understands." And the farmer picked up the little puppy and gave him to the boy. And the boy said, "How much?" And the farmer said, "You've already paid for it. Love is all he needs." And I did that without crying. The Spanish philosopher Unamuno said, "Spiritual love is born out of sorrow. People love each other only when they have suffered the same sorrow together." And I thought, that defines this fellowship. And it defines my experience with that small group in a very intense way, and in a less intense way with you today. And it happens through our sharing of our stories. That's how we connect. It's not about principles. It's not about rules. It's not about who's good or who's bad. It's not about competition. It's about one person sharing his or her story with another. And it's in that sharing and in that community where hope is found and lives are changed, where sharing reduces the pain and brings strength to the person. That's what happens in the AA group, and that was true also for me, and for that I'm incredibly grateful. So how is it now, 40 years later? What have I gained? Well, we don't have enough time for this part. So I've tried to write some notes so I'll be reasonably brief. And this may be a bit of a surprise to you, but part of what I've gained from this fellowship is a strengthening of my faith. As I said, one of the smart things I knew was that I didn't have answers to how to put Willie back in touch with God. We needed to work together. And it is that kind of sharing and that kind of being together that I've really discovered the presence of an active, dramatic God in my life. As if I didn't have it before. But I did, but y'all know what I'm saying. I mean, where else do you see a miracle week after week after week after week? Here's another miracle. In fact, what are there, 300 miracles sitting in this room? How can I be doubtful when I can look at that and see that? The place that we see the unseeable God is in the mutual, caring community. And that's true in church. Can be true in church. It's not always true in church. But it's true in AA. And as you might guess, one of the things that I have done with my life and my ministry is a lot of small group work. Because it's in the small group that lives are changed. And it's there that we see the unseeable God. In the love of the fellowship, we can experience the presence of God. We are created in such a way, it seems to me, that we are destined to think and speak and dream and know ourselves by virtue of the communities we participate in. God is experienced in the members of that healing community. And I think God likes being anonymous. And the community that incorporates that spirit of healing is an incorporation of the Spirit of God. And it's changed your lives, and it's changed my life. So the first thing that I've gained is the experience of the unseeable God in the loving and healing fellowship. Another that I've gained is that first things first. You know, our signs, our think, easy does it. Those are important. But the one that I need to keep in front of me is first things first. Because first things are my relationships. And frankly, especially my relationship with my wife. And what this fellowship has done for that relationship is amazing. It has strengthened our marriage. It has allowed, you know, you can be honest with your spouse, and then they get tired of hearing the same old thing over and over. We were in Florida, and I was on the staff of the cathedral, and the dean got elected a bishop, and they brought in a new dean, and he was horrible, and I knew I needed to get the hell out of there. And, you know, my wife and I could talk about that for a little bit, but 6 weeks later, there wasn't anything new to say. And what I knew was that I needed to keep that relationship first, and I needed to find other ways to live out some of the anxiety and stress in my life. That's a great lesson for a marriage, and this fellowship is a great place to live out some of those other things. It's not that I'm hiding them from my wife, but it's that I'm getting some of the tension out of them so that it's a sharing in which I'm not expecting her to carry my burden, but to share it. So first things first. And for me, those are relationships, not all the stuff that goes on in a congregation, not all the politics in our world, none of that, our relationships. Another thing that I've learned from this fellowship is to let go. I look at my teen years and I recognize that at the heart of that pain and that isolation was that I had substituted achievement for love. That I had substituted get people to respect and admire me rather than know and care about me. You know, even when you learn that's death, it doesn't go away. I'm an achievement-oriented sort of guy. I like to find problems and I mean, I went to Buffalo, and I like to fix them. And sometimes that works, and a lot of times it doesn't work. And I'm pretty good at achievement. I mean, I've been doing it all my life. But then I would leave And my successor would take apart 2/3 to all of what I had done for the place. Well, you got to learn to let go of that. I can't deal with that which is no longer my area, my authority. I can't deal with the failures that I had in the past. Well, somebody said acceptance is giving up on trying to make your past good. I learned that from you. Letting go. Recognizing that our successes and achievements are of no more value to us as human beings than our failures and our pain. But what is of value is to be open and honest with one another. It's a really different perspective. A part of that was learning that I can't do 12-step works. Now, when I first got involved with AA, back in that going to open meetings, and I think this is before Willie, and University of Louisville had seminars for clergy on alcoholism and addiction. They were fabulous. They were really good stuff. And I decided that I was going to save the world. I mean, I'm an achievement guy, right? And suddenly I know about alcoholism and I know about intervention and... Yeah, you know. It doesn't work that way. I literally pulled somebody out of a wreck, took him home, talked to him, talked to his wife. They never showed up at a meeting. I had another drunk run into me and total my car. I gave him literature. So far as I know, he never went to a meeting. And slowly I came to understand that my knowledge about can be helpful in some situations, but it's not going to solve the problem of somebody who's actively drinking. Because I could not give them hope, because I'm coming from the head to the head. And what they need to hear is a story of someone who has lived their pain, connect to that story, and recognize that that person's life is better put together today, and they truly are happy, joyous, and free. That's where hope is born. So what I learned to do, this life is a long time learning. What I learned to do is I would get a call from someone who's in crisis. Crises, as y'all know, are the most wonderful things that happen to drunks. And let's say wife called me that her husband had just gotten his third DWI. He was going to lose his license. He couldn't get to work. Where were they going to do? And I said, well, just hang on. We'll be out there. And then I would call a friend of mine in the fellowship. And we would go out. And I would talk with the non-alcoholic members of the family. And my friend would talk with the alcoholic. And I would do my best to get the non-alcoholic folk into Al-Anon and into counseling. And my friend would walk the person either to a treatment center or to a meeting. And we got pretty good. That worked because I recognized that I couldn't do it. As long as I was the expert going to fix everybody, we were all in trouble. And so I've learned to let go. You know, the 11th step is not about achievement, not about making it happen. It's about seeking to know God's will for us and having the power to carry it out. And part of what I've learned in this fellowship, and I watch y'all do 12-step calls, and I just get amazed. I still do. You go, you make a call, the person's life is in shambles, you share your story, you invite them to come, you offer to take them to meetings, and then you let it go. I have a hard time doing that. I suspect some of you do, but y'all have done it enough. We're not results people. We seek to do what God is calling us to do now. We seek to have the power to do that, and then you let it go. That's a hard lesson for a super achiever, but it's given me life in a way I'd never had it otherwise. Because my understanding of the 11th step was to make it happen according to my will. Let that go. All of which is pretty good for the ego. I have written a couple of times about the spirituality of the 12 steps. And for me, the very heart of that spirituality is to move from being ego-centered to letting go of the ego and becoming centered in service to others. And you know, as you begin to live into that, you begin to recognize that all of those wonderful gifts, or I begin to recognize that all those wonderful gifts that I have are really gifts from somebody else. They're gifts from my parents. They're gifts from my friends. They're gifts from the fellowship. They're gifts from the church. They're gifts from that friend that I would call up and let's go make a 12-step call. There's nothing that I can do that isn't the result of the gifts of those who have been around me. And I've also learned that the only inventory I can take is mine. That's not an easy learning either. And as you can imagine, again, this diminishing of ego-centeredness and moving toward a care and concern for others, first things first, is really good for a marriage. My wife and I have been married 47 years, and even she recognizes that the health of our marriage is partly the result of my involvement. She doesn't give it all to y'all, but partly the result of my involvement with you. And so, I've learned to be grateful. Community is a gift. That little group that developed when Willie walked into my office was a gift. We didn't make that happen. There are times we find that we belong, and there are times that we do not find it. But when we experience community, we can only be grateful. That's the only response we have. And this shouldn't be surprising, though it was for me, that gratitude is a primary quality that I find in this fellowship. Gratitude and humor, I think they're connected. I've come to understand that gratitude is not so much a feeling as it is a way of looking at the world. Gratitude is the recognition that everything that is important is a gift from others, from our parents, from our friends, from our teachers, from our co-workers, from members of the community that listen to my story and share their stories with me. Gratitude is not so much a feeling as it is a way of actually looking at the world, all the gifts that surround us. It's a way of looking at life and recognizing that everything that is important to us is a gift from others. Recovery, gratitude, and spirituality have the same essence, which is an orientation toward others. Our unspiritual selves are turned inward, focusing on self, but our spiritual selves live in grateful recognition that all we have been given, all that we have, has been given to us. I think this is why service is so essential in this fellowship. There's a kind of turning outward in a response to another person's need. That's really critical. This, of course, is why the 12th step is so important. Service to the still suffering alcoholic is a way that one can give what one has received and thereby remain grateful and thereby continue to receive more. I'm often thanked for my service in this fellowship, and I always reply that I get more than I give. That's the short answer. And it's true, but let me expand that just a little bit. While my spiritual journey began in the church, where I found a loving God who could love me even when I could not love myself, practicing the 12 steps and being present to this fellowship has strengthened that relationship, nurtured my spiritual growth, provided spiritual support for me personally and professionally. I've learned to be free. Free especially from that fear of being honest. And with that freedom comes happiness. I continue to let go and not regret the past or try to reorganize it. My successors at the seminary have done things radically different from what I did or from anything I would have done. I have to let it go. My life with this fellowship has helped me let go of being focused on that, letting go of the self-pity and the feelings that attach to dwelling on the past and allowing concern for others to become more central. Fear continues to diminish. I know that whatever happens together with others, we can handle it, no matter how baffling it may be. At the depth of my being, I understand that God is doing for me and for us what we could not and cannot do for ourselves. And if those words seem familiar, that's because the promises really are true for those of you in the fellowship. And thank God for me. I thank you for the gifts that you've given me by allowing me to be a part of this incredible fellowship. Thank you.